finalize projects.
Oh, that's right.
The stars are aligned.
Well, we already fixed it.
But it is scary though, because that water's cold, it's deep when you step out there.
Wherever Barbara has to assist with them, and it's already known that my fellow is sound.
So I think our mission is to
Yeah, they're having trouble. Hey, Madam Chair, we're here for you.
All right.
Hey.
How's it going?
Good.
How was your, were you going to Christmas dinner with your sister?
Oh, that's right. I was, yes, going, and I was trying to find her. I don't know if that's what
I'm doing. How are you doing?
She was
there. Excellent.
Yeah. She ended up calling me. I didn't know her. She just had changed numbers.
Yeah.
And so
we all know what that's all about.
And they had to escort me around.
Definitely know what that's all about.
Am I? Yeah.
Do you want to go ahead and start? I don't have a great big gavel, but I have a big mouth. So
thanks for thinking of me.
Yeah, let's use it. So we'll call the meeting to order. And we'll start with introductions, starting down here at the end.
I'm Alan Jones, the Director of Student Transportation, representing Randy Darn, Superintendent of Public Instruction.
I'm John Nesbitt. I'm the Director of Traffic Operations with the Department of Transportation, here on behalf of Secretary Peterson.
I'm Pat Kohler, Director, Department of Licensing, and I'm really wet. I'm trying to dry everything out here.
Good morning, everyone. John McKees, Chief of State Patrol.
Okay. I'm Carol Ann Schwartz. I'm Grant County Commissioner. That's what I am. And it's good to see that you people are complaining about this wet. We're not used to this on the west or east side.
Jim Swire from Vancouver, Clark County, representing the judiciary. Scott Waller with the Division of Behavioral Health and Recovery, representing Kevin Quigley, Secretary of Education.
Darren Grundell, Director of the
Faculty. Okay, do we have a quorum today? We do not.
We do not, for sure.
So, unless somebody shows up, how short are we?
We need, Alan, there's one, two, three, four. We need two more.
Is there anyone on the phone?
No.
Do you anticipate two people showing?
No. John Schneider, there's been some changes with John Schneider, but he will be here the last 30 minutes. So I think as far as minutes or the action council, I think we can go, we can move the minutes to April if we need to.
Or okay.
We can wait until, if Sandy may be here.
Okay, and how about action items? Are we going to have to table them or?
I think with the Action Council, we can go through with the discussion and we can move forward. I don't see that it prohibits us from moving forward.
Okay, very good. So, in that vein, I guess we don't need a motion to hold the minutes, do we? Because we can't vote on it anyway. All right, so we're just going to hold the minutes until the next meeting. And Commissioner Kohler, I guess you're going to give us information.
Yes, so we would like the Traffic Safety Commission to adopt a resolution, and I realize we can't adopt the resolution today. I have Brady Hornstein with me today, so if we have any additional information, Brady, that you want to chime in on, that'd be great, or answer any questions. But we would like to have a resolution put forward and approved by the commission to establish a council for an action council for young drivers and to help coordinate the statewide young driver safety efforts. We want it to be jointly led by the Traffic Safety Commission and the Department of Licensing. We would like to have representatives on the council from State Patrol, Department of Licensing, Department of Health, Department of Social and Health Services, Department of Transportation, OSPI, local government, public health, and law enforcement agencies, AAA, Professional Drivers Association, Washington Traffic Safety Education Association, Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorneys, Harborview Injury Prevention and Research Center, and other traffic safety experts as necessary. We would like to have the council meet at least quarterly and more frequently when necessary. And what we're hoping, I think this is a major deliverable out of it, is that we would recommend a comprehensive legislative package to the commission and to the governor in time for the 2017 legislative session that would address young driver issues. The council will develop a public awareness and outreach plan over the next year to raise awareness about young driver safety and build support for any legislative proposal that we would consider. And I have a timeline. I don't know, do we make copies of this stuff, Brady, for everybody, I think, right?
Yeah, in front of you in your packets is the resolution, the outline, and then there's a timeline specifically for your review. These were sent out electronically, I think on Wednesday or Tuesday, and then they're for you as well. So
the timeline, which might need to be adjusted because we can't adopt a resolution, would be that we would have the Young Driver Task Force start in January, and then we have an assessment that I think is still April, or is it May now?
First week of May.
Okay, so the assessment is coming up in May that we've jointly agreed to pay for. And then we have a policy summit young driver conference coming up in the May, I think it's about the May time period. The 17 package we would have to have ready by summer of 16. And then public outreach would occur between the summer and when the legislative package would occur. And then we would identify legislative champions and identify legislation officially submitted to OFM and so forth from our proposals, and then the package would go in 17. And that's the bigger session. We feel that with the young driver safety and that increasing, that unless we address some key policy issues, we will not be able to drive to target zero.
I'd like to speak in favor of the resolution, although I know we can't vote on it today without a quorum. I would like to speak in favor of it and pledge our support and participation as an agency.
Okay. Really noted. Anyone else? Anything added?
Do you want to add anything, Brady?
I guess I will just say we've been meeting informally. There's been a task force over the last several years, but the goal with this is to really reinvigorate that effort and get the right groups in the on a regular basis, is to put any sort of package together. It's great, Chief, to hear your support. To put something together is going to be an uphill battle, and I think that's with all these people in the room. We had an informal meeting last week, and with most of these partners were there, and very excited about the prospect of doing something bold. So we look forward to talking with all of you as member agency representatives in the near future about what that package really looks like. But as we've worked on the Target Zero Plan rewrite and the driver's side, it's clear that the legislative piece is huge, and addressing some funding deficiencies is huge, and we just really want to swing for that and make that happen the next year.
So. Well, I appreciate your insightful work and efforts on this as well.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Darren, we would then bring it back to April. Hopefully we have a quorum.
Yeah, we should have a quorum in April.
Okay. And then we would need to get it on July. We need to get it on July then for approval of any sort of DP.
Yes, the Action Council can continue to work in an informal manner. I see that's something we've already been doing, but as far as the adoption of a formal resolution, that would need to happen once we have a quorum. So, but I Madam Chair, if you might allow me just for a second. Brady and Angie back here have really taken the lead from both of our agencies, from DOL and the Traffic Safety Commission, and really looking at some of these things. And some of the initiatives I think we look at with young drivers are quite out of the box in some sense, and others that we've seen from other states that have been very effective. It's, you know, trying to get policymakers to understand kind of that bigger picture on our young drivers and helping them as far as we're getting to target zero. So we do have some heavy lifts in some areas, and I think that we can make some significant strides with the group that's already there. They've done some tremendous work, and I applaud them for that and appreciate that, because once we get some legislative priorities with the young drivers, then I think as far as the commission, helping to elevate those up through the governor's office and then into the legislative hopper in this next year. So we're looking at those strategies and areas that we can to affect young drivers in, you know, all areas, but particularly with young drivers, because if we can make an impact there, we'll have a discussion later, but it really helps to help change and maybe shape that traffic safety culture from that young age moving forward. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much, you two, for
allowing for the discussion.
Yes.
If there's a timeline associated with this that's sensitive, I'd recommend that we consider actually pushing the information out to the membership by email, and then we can vote that way to get it covered in the form of a quorum a lot faster.
Yeah, it was.
That's a good idea.
Can we?
I'm not sure we can do that under the Public Meeting Act requirement.
Okay.
But I will check to see if there is an option there.
Okay, I know we do, you know, I'm on a lot of boards, and we do it in other board settings, but I respect the requirements associated with this commission.
Right, so if they call them by phone or whatever.
Sure.
Yeah.
But of course, they haven't had the advantage of listening to the discussion that's happening
right
today either, so that's always a difficult one.
Well, what we also can do, because we love each other so much, I could call on, you know, a special session, and we could do that.
Sure.
But unless we want to wait till April.
For me, it's just a matter of whether or not we're up against the timeline, so
right.
I was just trying to help in getting it done a lot faster.
Right.
You know, I'd like to make a comment on this as well. I noticed the Department of Health is involved, and obviously we don't have someone here from the Department of Health today, but my mind was going, once this is in place, how do we get the word down to the local level? You know, it's one thing to sit up here and say, we're going to do this, this, and this. It's actually putting things in place and making them work. And how do we reach the young people? And I think of our health district. We do a lot of work through the schools and so forth out in the rural counties. That's one way to reach the people. And the other one was I was thinking, how do we get youth involved on this, and that's a little harder, I'm assuming, to do because of just the nature of the beast. But anyway, I just really recommend that we engage a lot of our local health districts in this, because they do have boots on the ground and they are working with people on a daily basis.
Is there a way to get local involvement in that policy summit young driver conference?
Yeah, and there are target zero managers, of course, throughout the state, and
exactly.
Something they've been invited and will be continue to be invited and included. And, absolutely. And local as well will be a priority.
And within that conference, is there a provision made for any youth voice, or have you thought through that at all?
Yeah, I mean, we're very early in just even figuring out the exact date of
right
when that event would be. But the idea is we haven't come together as young driver advocates and young drivers in more than a decade, really. Things, and to really just talk about where we are, where we've come, and but definitely, I mean, at the traffic safety conference that the commission held last fall, there were student panels, and those were very well received, and I think we'd love to have more of those, more opportunities.
Through our community prevention and wellness initiative across the state, we have a number of youth coalitions that I think we probably could tap some of those folks to in the state.
Okay, Chairman, would it be possible, Brady, could you just touch a little bit on some of the, we're getting ready to roll out some changes to young drivers in June on the testing, which is, I think, going to make a huge difference in making it a little bit more challenging for a young driver to be able to pass and be qualified to be on the road.
Yeah, so Pat touched on this at the partners meeting. But we are rolling out June 1st some improvements to our driver guide and knowledge test and our driver curriculum, that we kind of our model driver education curriculum. And really for the first time, we took the Target Zero plan, which obviously acknowledges the priorities, and we held that up against our curriculum guide and our knowledge test and identified the gaps, and making obviously high priority areas like impairment ideally should be covered, you know, commensurate with the priority that it is in the Target Zero plan because of the involvement in collisions and fatal collision and serious injury collisions. So we've done that work and we've released the curriculum out to our schools, which bolsters content around impairment, distracted driving, and other key factors. It has some hazard awareness content, some other improvements like that. We've also added bolstered content in our driver guide around those topics as well. We've added a lot more information around impairment, including drugs. Before it was primarily just a little mention about alcohol, but because of the changing environment, we've added more information there. Added much more information around distracted driving. And then really to finish it off is expanding our knowledge test, the written test that all of you remember. It's going from 25 questions to 40 questions, so a much longer test, a much more thorough test to cover far more topics. DOL actually hadn't made changes to that test in quite some time. And a lot of the questions have been removed over time, but we never had the resources to put any new ones in. So thanks to a grant from the commission, we were able to hire consultants to review questions. A psychometrician is called to review the questions and validate the questions. And that's all on track to be delivered June 1st, which is really exciting. Because we've done some basic things. We used to have a practice test on our webpage, and it was actually the test. You could refresh and take it over and over and over again, and eventually you would have seen all of the questions. And the passage rate was in the 80%. We took that down and just put a very simple practice question, a few practice questions, and the passage rate dropped down to the 60s. So, it's not good that people are failing, but it demonstrates that people probably weren't learning this material and processing and thinking about it critically. They were just memorizing. So we're excited about all of this and within kind of the authority we have as an agency, but we really see the legislative piece as the next step to really make some improvements. So, but we're really excited to deal well about getting re-engaged and really elevating all of this.
I think going from 25 to 40 questions is going to be huge. Much more ability to test comprehensively and much more challenging for the tester to be able to pass that test.
Yeah. We've added some too that you remember those. They're very basic questions like how many feet signal before turning, things like that, very basic questions. We've added, we're going to give it a whirl and see how well it's received. It's more situational questions, like a story problem questions. Describe a driver who's in a situation. Maybe a bad thing happened, and then we ask the test taker, what should they have done differently? To see if, I think those will be difficult, and we'll measure whether people get those right or not. Share that with you.
Just a question.
Yes.
Hey, you talked about impaired driving. Does that incorporate with legalization of marijuana? Some questions in that as well.
Absolutely. So we're adding content. We added content around just basically that prescription drugs and marijuana, and some of the, even though you haven't used marijuana for several hours, for example, that it can still affect your driving. And really deep down, far more detail for the driver, the person studying or reading the drive. So it's far more comprehensive in that way.
Yeah, we're also looking at some educational materials that we can do for those 20 to 21-year-olds in impaired driving. And we do like that early warning letter, and we've done that date. We showed you the data where we send to the 20, I think it's the 20 to, or was it 18 to 20-year-olds or some in that window. We send them a letter when they get their first ticket. We're actually looking at sending drivers some information when they turn 21 about impaired driving.
We know drivers are, they come to our office or they go online to get a replacement license, so it switches the normal direction.
Horizontal, vertical to horizontal.
So that's an opportunity to just, hey, welcome to driving over age 21. And, so in addition to materials in our office, we've been talking internally about when people renew online through License Express, that's a great time to give people, you can start playing a video right there. They can ignore it, but right there, get some information right to thousands and thousands of people.
It's an exciting time to see what's happening, especially in the Endeavor Arena, and this is really that kind of that testament of the strategic highway safety plan and how agencies are utilizing it to then look and compare and do gap analysis in some of their own curriculum and their own processes. So once again, thank you very much for doing that. It's an exciting time. I'm looking forward to seeing how this group works. So.
Well, what I find refreshing is that you're taking the data and putting it to work. And, you know, what we've been hearing at the conferences and so forth, and to see it actually in action. It'd be interesting to know how, especially on the marijuana situation, how Colorado's handling this and the other states that are involved, or if they are.
I will tell you this. My data manager is not in here today, but I was on the call with, his name is Glenn Davis from Colorado. Many of you might know him from various presentations. He's the impaired driving coordinator from Colorado. And we were talking, and he says, Darren, he says, what's amazing is how your state is using the data and how much further ahead you are than we are with the data, especially the report that we had just put out with the marijuana and the toxicology data and fatal and serious injury crash data. As he says, we use your report all the time. He says, you have 62 pages addressing that, and I have a small paragraph on my website about it. So it's exciting to see that, you know, and get some of that feedback from other states seeing, you know, the value of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. So.
Great.
Welcome.
No.
How are you?
Yes.
We won't point you out, but you were just getting here.
I left another meeting to be at this meeting.
I know.
Then I'll go back to that meeting.
That is that all you have?
Yep.
Thank you very much. Okay, so on to, welcome. To Shelley. Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council and the legislative session.
All right, so last legislative session, there was a bill passed that asked us to start a Pedestrian Safety Advisory Council, and we got a half-time position in order to run that council. The council, well, actually, I'm going to introduce the gentleman that we hired to run the council. I feel like I will tell you that when we knew we had a half-time position, we were really concerned about the quality of candidates that would apply and what we would end up with. And not only did we get a high-quality candidate, we got probably the best candidate we could hope for somebody who has a background in bicycle and pedestrian safety, who's been very involved locally in the Thurston County and City of Olympia bicycle and pedestrian plans. He has an understanding that he brings to this office that the rest of us don't have about planning and pedestrian safety. So when you spread things out, it makes pedestrians much more vulnerable than when you have things that are compact and they can walk and there's lots of walkers, which makes them safer. And concepts that I haven't gotten yet, but he's going to teach me. So I'd like to introduce Larry Levine.
Morning, Larry.
Welcome. And Larry, why don't you go ahead and just tell him a little bit about your plans for getting the council started and what it'll look like.
Well,
Come on up.
That's just so that's what he really wants to do.
Well, after all of the training and orientation that I have to do entering the state workforce, Shelley and I have already met with one of the co-sponsors of the legislation, Representative Farrell, and we'll be meeting with Senator Elias next week. Just to get a little more of a personal communication going about their interests, why the legislation spoke to them, just to kind of build relationships and maintain relationships. A group like this, multidisciplinary, multi-agency, I'm sure you understand the importance of that. I'm attending many meetings, advisory councils, and others. It was great to come on board the day before the Target Zero Partners meeting, so I could really jump in and see what was going on and the tremendous partnerships you have across the state. And taking that knowledge and starting to see what sorts of formats of an advisory council might work, what we could learn from all of those existing partnerships. I am also making lots of contacts for, if not direct potential participants of the advisory council, at least folks they could put me in touch with or say, oh, you should really consider this person. They're very passionate about pedestrian safety. They're very knowledgeable in this special area. So I'm gathering all those contacts. And I've also been reaching out to other state agencies, notably Department of Transportation, Department of Health, and Department of Commerce, because I'm seeing Shelley referenced this, a little bit of a siloed work and interest in growth management and commerce and active communities, the Department of Health, and certain aspects of transportation planning at Department of Transportation, and wanting to just kind of break through those silos and just connect them a little bit more, because land use, obviously our Target Zero goals are going to be very, very challenging to meet, and we need every tool in the toolbox. And so land use, as a former planning commissioner in Olympia for almost a decade, and being involved in the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee for about 5-6 years as well here, that land use component is really crucial. It's a challenging tool to use. It doesn't always have the traction, if you will, in all areas of the state, but it's a really important one for various reasons, and I won't take up your time with them, but I'm trying to be cognizant of the important work, stay focused on Target Zero goals, and bring everything that I can to help us achieve those, and I'm really impressed, if I can just take a second to say, with my colleagues' hard work and dedication. This is a sharp group of folks, and I'm really honored, really, really honored to be among them working for you all.
I'll slip you the 20.
Thank you very much.
I think the timing on this is so perfect, because as we're undergoing our Target Zero rewrite, what we believed at the beginning of this venture was that as we affected those areas that were the most prevalent, so something like impairment that runs through all of these other, you know, it's 50% of our traffic problem, it's 50% when we look at speed, it's 50% when we look at all these other areas, that as we reduced impairment, we should make progress in these other areas as well, and that's been true somewhat. But pedestrians is the one area where we've seen reductions overall, and pedestrians have been very, very flat. They haven't apparently benefited from the other reductions in the programs that we've been doing. And the way that we're looking at Target Zero this year, I think will help us see that if we're going to work on reducing pedestrians, we may have to actually look specifically at pedestrians to make those improvements. So I think the timing could be better for us. And you want the legislative report now?
Yes, please.
Okay. Make sure I'm not out of turn.
Nope.
So our biggest item this year, once again, is the distracted driving bill. Last year, we did well with it. We had Senator Rivers as a sponsor in the Senate, prime sponsor, and she was remarkable and managed to push it all the way through and get it out on the floor of the Senate with a positive vote. We weren't so lucky in the House, where it had a hearing in the House Transportation Committee, but did not get executive session nor voted out. This year, we have a new prime sponsor for the bill, Representative Farrell, and she is, I'm very excited about her ability to influence the House Transportation Committee, hopefully get a hearing on it, and be able to hopefully push it out for a vote. She's going to hold a work group next Wednesday, 12:30 at JLOB Room 302. So if you have legislatively active people and you could send them to support the distracted driving bill, we would be most appreciative. It's an uphill battle. There are 25 people in the committee. We need 13 votes, and to my best count, we have 11 or 12. So every single contact that we make on this bill with that committee is vital.
I can ask a question. Do we have a pretty good feel for where we lost traction in the House in terms of reasoning?
Yes. So the argument in the House is, what I've heard, the biggest, most vocal argument is we shouldn't separate out cell phones from all the other distractions. That putting on your makeup and reading a book and whatever else you're doing is all distracting and dangerous behavior behind the wheel. So there's no reason for us to separate out cell phones from all those other things. Their solution to that would be to have a law that says if you're doing something other than driving and you cause a crash, then your ticket's double, which I'm not against. But what that does for the cell phone legislation is it takes us backwards to a secondary enforcement. Right?
So
instead of being able to stop someone because they're like this or like this, you wouldn't be able to stop them until they were doing this and they did something. So in response to that, I'll say we had that discussion in 2007. We've already separated out cell phones from other distractions, and we did so for really good reasons. I can actually reach down and grab a french fry and put it in my mouth with one hand on the steering wheel and my eyes ahead and without engaging very much in my brain. A cell phone is not like that. A cell phone requires your hands to hold it, your fingers to push it, your eyes are attached to it, and your brain is trying to remember how to give the commands and get where you want to go and have this conversation and whatever. It's a very complicated distraction. But we had that discussion in 2007. We had it again in 2010. Both times, they voted to separate out cell phone as a distraction that was distinct. In 2007, when we did that, we were the first state in the nation to separate out cell phones as a distraction and say, hey, don't do that. Since that time, well, we had flip phones in 2007. So phones have only gotten more complicated, and our understanding of distraction around cell phones has only gotten much sharper and clearer. We've done cognitive studies. We know that there's a lot of low-level distractions that happen, but using your cell phone, especially if you're entering data into it, is a very high-level distraction. It takes your eyes off the road for a prolonged period of time, and it's very dangerous. I will say it's hard because we don't have concrete data on it, because when an officer shows up at our crash and he says, what happens? The only way we get a record cell phone is if the person says, well, I was talking on my cell phone. And we have instances of that. Right after we didn't pass it last year, we had two crashes where the person who caused the crash admitted, one was a fatal crash, that they were reaching for their cell phone. The other was a crash on an I-5 that held up traffic for hours because it happened right at rush hour. In both those cases, the person said, yeah, I was reaching for my cell phone. You know, but it's rare. Most times when they show up, they say, I don't know, or I was checking my rearview mirror, or whatever. So we have cell phones at about 2% of our crashes. 2% of the distracted crashes are listed specifically as cell phones. I don't see any way that we're going to get around that. It's not like impairment where we can run a test and we can say, nope, we see alcohol, you were impaired, or drugs, or whatever. So cell phone data is always going to be difficult, but those people who've been studying it and estimate, I think National Safety Council says it's 26% of all crashes involving a cell phone. I think it holds up traffic at rush hour.
I was going to comment that possibly some of the pushback on the bill is because of the way it's written, too. I mean, when you're... because it's so hard to define when you're on the cell phone and so forth. And, you know, actually the cell phones have become more, because right here it says, obviously, cell phone use includes talking, texting, and entering data into a device, so you see people doing this. However, you're allowed to touch it and activate it. So what's the difference? You know, you see it one way, and then you might not know that what's really happening is something totally different, if you're following me on that. But what triggered me to think about this and how important it is. When we were at this conference last fall, and our speaker was Matt Reichtel, is that how you pronounce it? Reichtel, who wrote A Deadly Wandering. I picked up his book, and I'm just about finished with it, and it's so scary, it's incredible. But they have a lot of data out there. There's a lot of data that tells you what is happening, which is totally different than putting on lipstick, yes, eating a french fry, or reading a newspaper.
There's that whole addictive piece of it. There's that lizard brain that reacts.
Exactly.
You hear your cell phone ring, everything in your body says, I need to connect to people, that's how I live.
And what I'm saying, I guess, is until these people understand what the problem is, the addictive nature of it, I don't think that they'll appreciate the bill as it is. I know I'm sounding like devil's advocate here.
No, I think that's really good input, and I think you're right. You know, I think, AAA kind of helped me understand this year, and that was, our law says, please be hands-free. So we know that the conversation is distracting, the trying to tell your Siri to find this particular song on your iPod is distracting. But when AAA studied in-car distractions, they were able to actually map mentally how long people were distracted, how long certain commands took to take place, and they put all of vehicle manufacturers' systems through a testing and rated them low distraction, mid distraction, high distraction, and went back to the manufacturers and said, hey, your system is the worst one out there. It takes a minute and a half to place a phone call using your voice. And the next year, the worst manufacturer in that list, when they retested their new model, they were one of the lowest distractions. So they're going to make this information available at the same place on the Insurance Institute website where you can go and get safety ratings for your car. You can also see how distracting their in-car navigation systems are. So their attitude is a little bit like, we're not going to get rid of this. People want to be connected. But we're going to do it as at that lowest level distraction as possible. So even though there are many advocates out there that would say you just need to keep your cell phone in the trunk, don't be messing with it, it's hard to enforce a voice-activated command to your cell phone, right? As an officer, you can't tell if they're singing to the car or talking to their phone, if they're not holding it or punching numbers into
they're
it.
They're psychopathic.
Yeah, so I think that the law is as good as we're going to get right now, and I think that technology is only going to help us use this technology in a safer manner rather than in the worst possible manner.
So not to belabor the issue, but it's such a problem across the country that one state is considering legislation that empowers the officer at roadside to actually, if they suspect, observe and suspect, they can ask the violator to show me your texting to prove that you weren't or you were texting at roadside.
Yeah, a warrantless telephone search.
That's correct.
Isn't that protocol for investigations for fatal crashes is first thing is to confiscate the cell phones?
You can, with the help of the prosecutor, get a warrant, yes.
Here we need a warrant.
Yeah, we need a warrant.
And once you compensate the cell phone, if it's locked...
Yeah. Problematic.
It's problematic.
But again,
technology can help
us
in that eventually, but right now most of them are very difficult to break.
Yeah, the ideal situation is not having the officers actually physically take someone's phone, because then you'll have accusations about going through and getting into privacy issues where you stray off in areas you shouldn't. That's what we don't want to get into. Or be responsible for breaking someone's $1,000 cell phone.
The other argument against, so the argument against is that we shouldn't separate. My argument about that is we did that. We've already done that twice now.
Yeah.
And there's even better data out there as why we need to. The second argument I hear is that people want to use their GPS and it's better than looking at an atlas, which would be perfectly legal. And my response to that is, it's perfectly legal to use, if this bill passed, to use your GPS. Set your directions before you leave, let the phone talk to you, and don't touch it again until you get to where you're going. It's technology there has really come a long way since 2007 when we were first having these discussions. If your phone doesn't talk to you, you can mount it and watch the map, but.
We're having the same conversations with school bus drivers, and we're about to do a WAC change that would prohibit the use of any personal communications device unless authorized by school district policy, which would say no cell phones, no anything. But the other thing we're dealing with is just these tablets that include the pre-trip instructions, and they want to have them interactive to provide routing information, so you can be don't have your subs get lost, which is a big issue, but there's really a lot of pushback from people that don't want any interaction with that device. And I think it's less distracting than holding a, than having a sub hold a bunch of route papers and trying to drive and read this at the same time, but not have them be able to interact with that device, just have them get directions from it the way that it,
GPS works.
Right.
Yeah.
That very, very difficult conversations. A lot of people are very opposed to anything like that.
And it's multiplied when you think about the other transit drivers out there as well. So last year we went through every transit device that we could find. Even their little potato mics now are actually running over wireless carriers because it's cheaper. So there's a huge discussion about that. This version of the bill exempts transit drivers. I don't think we'll get it through politically without doing that. Lots of issues around that. And any help you guys can lend, we need it, and we would really, really appreciate it.
My recommendation is going back there, is just really to provide them with as much raw data. I mean, there are lots of statistics out there that really tell about how addictive this is. I mean, it just blows my mind. No pun intended there.
It's getting worse.
But it is getting worse. I know their time is limited. I mean, we've all dealt with the legislature on various issues, and until you really sit down and have an in-depth conversation with them, they really don't get it.
Yeah.
But I think that the more stuff we feed them, the better.
I agree. Thank you for that. The other one I'm just going to mention quickly is the 24/7 sobriety program, that's a mistake, 6236. Senator Patton's bill is looking to expand, again, the 24/7 program. The only problem is that the way that he did it in the original bill would interfere with our funding. So at one point, we would allow 24/7 in lieu of Ignition Interlock. We get Ignition Interlock funding specifically because Ignition Interlock is a requirement for everybody convicted of DUI. So if we take that requirement away, we would lose about $400,000 a year.
So can you talk a little bit about the success or lack thereof of the current 24/7 program? I'll personally say, professionally say, that it isn't working. I mean, there's no money behind it, and without that, you're hard-pressed to get local governments to want to participate.
Yes.
It's an unfunded mandate.
There's been very limited acceptance. There's been a few jurisdictions that have tried it and stopped. There have been some that really wanted to and just could not find the economic way to make it work. It's struggling.
It's a great concept if we had the funding to make it work.
There are other states that have used it and have worked with it.
South Dakota.
Yeah, South Dakota, especially Montana. The funding mechanism that we get, of course, the FAST Act was just passed, and there were some changes in the FAST Act that made people think that parity had been achieved between Interlocks and 24/7. And that statement's true if you're looking at the 164 transfer, which we remember we were subject to. It didn't impact us too much because all the money that came to us, we were able to give it right back to DOT. Now, under the FAST Act, that's not an option for us anymore. If we violate 164, the funding would come to us and could only be used for 402 projects. So that would be a great, let's do it, except that I also drive on these roads and I prefer our cement money stay where our cement money is, right?
Right, that's been going to traffic, to safety improvements, you know, highway improvements.
Right, it put a rope around your funding. Mm-hmm. This, you know, so if we're not subject to it, you have much more freedom. It's better for the state. Mm-hmm. But the funding that we're concerned about is the 405 funding. So under MAP 21, that's where we got this ignition interlock funding for having an all-offender ignition interlock law. That's been $400,000 a year for the past 3 years. FAST 21 added a provision for about 3% of funds for 24/7 programs. The bill that that Patton introduced would have allowed 24/7 in lieu of suspension. The 24/7 funding that's available requires that everybody be subject to a suspension and the 24/7 program be available. So we wouldn't even be able to get the 24/7 program funding under the way the law was written. We've been working with them. We've been, you know, letting them know where our funding is impacted. trying to really help them understand the different regulations that are involved, just, you know, not want to trigger those, but maybe there's some leeway to do other things to help it spread. So one thing is, the way the bill is written now, you could substitute that 1 day or 2 days in jail for your first-time offender for 24/7.
There's been great research that tells us, though, that individuals who are suspended are more prone to being involved in other future accidents than those who are not suspended. So we have to pay attention to those that are suspended.
To the getting suspended.
Right.
The substitute for jail time wouldn't affect the suspension.
Yeah.
We did send an email that Darren, I think, is included in on some that our concerns aren't being shared as well. Like the no suspension means that we can't
do the assessments.
Yes, we can't. We have no teeth to.
Right.
Yeah, and we not doing assessments would subject us to the 164 transfer. So, that's another really important part.
And then there's no provision for reporting system as well.
Right.
Okay.
Also, without the suspension, how do we get to the felony DUI eventually, which people
deserve
to get to?
That's
for
us.
A problem.
It is. There's a lot of problems. I will say that staff has been interested in working around them, which is good.
Thank you.
I'll just remind folks that the governor it's very important to have this 24/7 program, so really thankful that y'all are working with them and trying to figure out how to make 24/7 work, because it is a good model. It looks like a promising practice, and we think it has potential if we can work through the kinks.
It's a complicated funding area that we don't want to trip.
Absolutely.
And we've got a lot of really good things in place that we don't want to mess up. Jail time, however, I think is one of those areas where locals are overburdened.
Yeah.
And they may find money for 24/7 if they could give up some jail time.
And they do get some money for jail time based on the 2013. There's some money that goes directly to the counties.
Weren't we contributing through traffic safety funds as well towards jail time for DUIs at one time?
Under Target Zero Teens program, it was an option. So if they, while they were on overtime for Target Zero Teens, arrested somebody and there was tremendous jail cost involved, they could ask us for help paying for that. Nobody ever has, even though we made an option.
Is there any help through MAP 21 in terms of dealing with behavioral issues that we could look to contribute to this problem? Because there is behavioral condition money in MAP 21.
Yeah, so MAP 21 was the last one. FAST Act is where we're at right now. They just passed in November. And FAST Act does have behavioral funding. We're doing our best to qualify for as much of that as we can. Behavioral comes to our office, and that's how we give out grants.
Yeah. Again, the concept's great. We just need a little help to help the locals, because they just cry about it being an unfunded mandate.
Yeah, and they could, because of the way the FAST Act was written. If there's a local that's interested in the 24/7 program, our grants are out right now, our request for grants, so a locality could apply to a grant, could apply to us for grants to help their 24/7 program.
Madam Chair, we had a question in the audience.
Wes Rethel from the Lewis County Sheriff's Office, and I think the group has already touched on it a little bit, you know, the unfunded mandate piece of running a 24/7 program is a small piece to it. I think the bigger piece to it is the judicial discretion or lack thereof that goes along with this. And that's where the locals run into problems is, you know, there's certain things that are mandatory when someone violates the conditions of the 24/7. And the jail costs, of which the judges don't have any discretion over. So if someone gets to a point where they have numerous violations of it, there's that automatic jail time for up to a year. And that is an incredible cost that comes back to the local agencies for housing that inmate for a year. So if there is some way that they can take a look at that particular piece to it, I think it would be much more palatable for local agencies to participate in the program. Because really, the cost of running the program, I think local agencies can find creative ways in order to do it. But what they can't do is they can't find creative ways in order to pay for the housing of that inmate for up to a year for those people that violate. And so if that piece can be addressed, I know particularly with our agency, I think it would be much more palatable for us to take a look at that if that could be addressed. Because you look at housing an inmate, it's about $90 a day to house an inmate. And if there's no judicial discretion in that, local agencies, they can't afford that.
Yeah. And I think that WASPIC really heard that.
Yeah.
And part of this bill includes that last section where they had mandated first violation equals X and second violation equals Y. They've adjusted that section of it in this bill quite a bit. I think that that is the part that WASPIC is really saying,
mm-hmm.
tell them what you want about your funding, but just don't mess with section C because we really need that. So yeah, that is something that I think is being much more reasonable in this bill than it has been. Any other questions? There's a large DUI omnibus bill. I provided kind of a guidance to it in the packet. And so I'm looking at my packet and I realize the printer only copied one side. So before you leave, I will get you the whole packet. So you are not just looking at blank pages on the back where all the really good information is. I feel like I've taken way too much time already, but I'm available if you have any other questions about the legislation. There's a couple of young driver bills coming for hearing. Word group.
Okay, so next on our agenda is voting under the influence.
So if I could just do a little introduction.
Sure.
I'd like to introduce Wade Alonzo.
Hi.
From State Parks. Is it Hoyle?
Hoyle, yes.
Okay, Hodges from State Parks. Wade and I actually had a conversation at one of the Washington Association of Sheriffs and Police Chiefs Conference about some of the changes and some of the things with voting under the influence. Because we all know that during the high voting season and during that time, we have a lot of people that go out, they drink, they participate in that on the water, and they get in their cars and they drive home. So if there's ways to help mitigate some of that, the carnage on our roadways through that, State Parks is doing a pretty amazing job with this. And so I'm going to turn the time over to them and kind of talk about some of the things that they're doing and some changes with what they're doing with field sobriety tests
yeah.
with voters.
Thank you very much.
So welcome.
So my role, Wade Alonzo from State Parks, my role is to manage the voting safety program. We're mandated by the Coast Guard to make boating as safe as possible in Washington State. My title is Boating Law Administrator. I'm the Darren Grondell of boating. So Hoyle is a Marine Law Enforcement Coordinator. One of the roles we play is we have agreements with 53 agencies around Washington State that actually do the patrol and enforcement and public safety patrols on our waterways. So we serve across Washington State, not just in parks, but our program is housed in state parks. We're a very similar program actually to Washington Traffic Safety Commission, just focused on the water. The sort of order of magnitude of the number of fatalities we face here around 30. So we're far less than traffic, but one of the things we know is when alcohol involvement is known in a fatality, it accounts for about 30% of the involvement in fatalities, boating fatalities. So it's an area we overlap with traffic, and as Darren said, BUI can often turn into a boating under the influence, can turn into driving under the influence. Well, a special challenge on the water is that when an officer is administering a field sobriety test, you can't do a walk and turn because you have a moving platform. And so the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators, which I'm a member of, funded research into an alternative seated field sobriety test. We wanted to share that with you. It's something we're training, Hoyle is training all the officers in Washington State to go through so that when they're able to do BUI detection enforcement, they're able to use this on the water. It's being used quite extensively around the country, and some terrestrial law enforcement is starting to use this on land because it can be applicable to situations where you have somebody that suffers from vertigo or maybe they have
an
injury or other things like that they can't do a walk and turn either. Mm-hmm. So there's some other applications. So we wanted to share this with you so you could see it firsthand and also maybe start a conversation about the applicability of it to the land. So I think you have that queued up, I think. This is a video that was produced by NASBLA specifically for judicial outreach. So.
many fatalities nationwide are associated with alcohol, and if we can find a way to reduce that, we're ultimately saving lives. When you encounter someone who has broken the law, they need to be addressed.
And they help the officer establish probable cause by providing a series of cognitive function, and the field sobriety tests confirm that.
We can use an NFO, we can make the arrest decision right then and there. That's why it's important.
On behalf of all 56 states, U.S. territories, and the District of Columbia, I'd like to take a few minutes to inform you about a new seated battery of field sobriety tests. It's just a matter of time before you start seeing cases involving these tests. And like you, we would prefer that you had a brief exposure to them so there are no surprises in a hearing or during trial. The seated battery was developed as a result of recent scientific research. Just as NHTSA and the IACP have partnered for decades to develop field sobriety tests and training to help officers deal with the problems associated with DUI, the U.S. Coast Guard and the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators, or NASBLA, partner to save lives on our nation's waterways by improving officer effectiveness at enforcing the laws against boating under the influence, or BUI. Until recently, Marine law enforcement officers had to rely on a series of what we call a float tests to help establish probable cause for a BUI arrest. Those tests, which in part included a finger dexterity test, counting backward, and reciting the alphabet, have served us well for decades and will continue to be relied upon until we fully transition to the seated battery of tests. Administered in a standardized manner and then evaluated as layperson's observations, study has shown that officers using the afloat tests could reach an arrest, no arrest decision, similar to when roadside tests were used. But we have faced some challenges. Some courts still expected to see evidence from the walk and turn and one-leg stand tests in DUI cases, thus leading to issues with suspect transport on the water and finding a suitable testing location. There have been questions about having a suspect perform balance-related tests after being on the water for all or part of the day. Additionally, as people in the U.S. have become increasingly overweight and are living longer, there are more times when the weight placed on walk and turn and one-leg stand evidence may come into question. Recognizing the benefits of developing a seated battery of field sobriety tests which have no dependency on balance or equilibrium, the Coast Guard and NASBLA partnered to have research performed with a goal of scientifically validating a seated battery of field sobriety tests. This three-year project involved the research team from the Southern California Research Institute, the same organization that has researched sobriety testing in the U.S. for NHTSA and IACP since the 70s. Consistent with previous research, this project involved both laboratory and field research, which ultimately proved validity of this battery of tests during actual on-water BUI investigations. In 2009, the research was completed and the final report was both peer-reviewed and published in at least one scientific journal. Training is now being conducted around the nation to implement the seated battery of tests, with the primary focus on marine law enforcement. The seated battery of tests starts with horizontal gaze nystagmus, conducted in the seated position. The next test is finger to nose, which requires the suspect, who is seated, to tilt the head back to about a 45-degree angle and close the eyes. The suspect is then required to touch the very tip of the index finger to the very tip of the nose using the hand specified by the officer. There are six attempts to make the finger-to-nose contact, all done in a systematic order. The next test is the palm pat. In this test, the suspect is to begin with both hands palm-to-palm, hands and fingers parallel. Then the suspect is to turn the top hand over and count one when the hands make contact. Then turn that top hand back over and count two when the hands make contact. Repeating this, keeping the hands and fingers parallel, and speeding up until told to stop. The suspect performs this within a 10 to 15 second time period. The final test is called hand coordination. It was developed by the researchers just as was the walk and turn test back in the 70s. Like the walk and turn, which requires the suspect to perform tasks like balancing in position while the instructions are given, walking and counting nine heel-to-toe steps down a line, making a turn in a specified manner, then walking and counting nine heel-to-toe steps back down the line,
This test requires the suspect to perform four specific and simple tasks. Starting with the fists against the chest as directed, the first task is to count 1, 2, 3, 4 as the fists are moved in step-like fashion away from the chest. The second task is to memorize the position of the fists, clap 3 times, then return to that memorized position. The third task is to count 5, 6, 7, 8 as the fists are moved in step-like fashion back toward the chest, returning the left fist to the chest. The fourth task is to open the hands and place them palms down in the lap. Each of the seated tests has standardized administrative procedures, clues, and evaluation criteria. By combining all the elements of a DUI investigation with the seated battery of tests, officers will be even more effective at identifying impaired operators, and in most cases, will have no need to conduct additional field sobriety tests. We have also found the seated battery to be quite valuable when we deal with DUI suspects who have mobility impairment, are grossly overweight, or have other balance-related problems. Each year in June, we conduct a nationwide DUI education and enforcement initiative called Operation Drywater, and participation has been increasing every year. Many states are beginning to use the new seated battery of tests this year, so the likelihood of encountering a case where they were used in your jurisdiction is increasing. The states, working through NASBLA, are committed to providing you the necessary resources, and we want to provide you access to reports, articles, and contact information for researchers and others who can answer questions or provide insight. I encourage you to visit the NASBLA website at nasbla.org/sobrietytest for access to this important information. Thanks for your interest and all you do to help us keep our nation's waterways as safe and enjoyable as possible. We appreciate your support. These people are personally and professionally motivated to create a better record.
We're all going to try it now, right?
So we
I'm resisting the urge.
So we train this every spring. Hoyle's got puts on a boarding of the influence class. We actually run a wet lab, and we put 24 officers per class through this and train this and
creational environment for the voters across the United States.
We've been doing this for probably 8 years maybe, I think, So anyway, just wanted to bring this to your attention, and we have a few minutes for questions, if that's for discussion.
So I think from the big part of it is that, you know, during water follies, during seafare, during some of these other things, you know, we oftentimes will run some of our high visibility enforcement campaigns, you know, with DUI, and I think some people sometimes just think, well, that's just driving a car. And so kind of maybe combining some of these elements is looking at, you know, from DUI to DUI. I think it was last year or 2 years ago, they updated the vehicular homicide statutes to incorporate a DUI.
That's correct, yeah.
And or a voting influence. So there's lots of changes in this arena. And so I know several of the counties and several municipal agencies are getting, they have marine units. And so being able to kind of marry those up at those same time helps, I think, as far as getting the information out, understanding that, yeah, you're still using a motorized vehicle to operate when you're under the influence. And so combining these and having this at least familiarity for all the commissioners and those that are here to see. Am I done? You can come up. Really helps to, I think, kind of see how do we help affect this. You know, especially with public education, because I don't think people sometimes think about voting. Yeah. You know, when I was at the Seafair a couple years ago and went out with one of the units, and we had one guy that was driving, and we watched him coming in because they were in a no-wake zone, and they were moving pretty fast.
Yeah.
And so the one guy was driving, and he says, hey, can you take the wheel for a second? So the guy steps back, and he did his thing. The other guy steps up, and he starts driving. We get him stopped. We ended up arresting both drivers for DUI.
Right.
Or for BUI. So, because they were both operating.
Yep.
So, I don't think people think about how much they've consumed. They're out on the water, and it's hot sun. You know, I think this is a... And then they get in their cars and drive away.
Right.
So.
So, again, we wanted to bring this to you all and introduce ourselves and also just expose you to the seated battery maybe that's a conversation starter, maybe it's not, about his use terrestrial as well. So we partner, thanks for bringing up CFIR. CFIR is actually kind of a success story in boating. You know, 10, 15 years ago, it was pretty much the Wild West, very much a lot of underage drinking, a lot of injuries, a lot of BUI. So Washington State Patrol worked closely with Mercer Island, King County, Seattle Harbor Patrol, and state parks. And they've been doing, and the Coast Guard, putting on a cooperative campaign up there that over the last 10 years has really brought those injuries and fatalities down by really focusing on boating with the influence. It's been a great partnership, but we're continuing that. So that's pretty much all we have. So
I do have a question for you. So alcohol impairment is one thing. Increasingly, of course, we're seeing marijuana impairment, and the same thing happens. You get impaired on the boat, you get in your car, it's still impairment.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, first off, just kind of a response, what your folks are saying about marijuana consumption as they make their stops. And then also, was there any consideration as you were doing the seated sobriety test to being able to determine impairment from marijuana as a result of that with field sobriety tests now basically use it as a process of elimination to investigate further.
So let me answer this. Go ahead.
So right now I have our boating under the influence instructors who are certified through NASBLA, and they're also DREs, drug recognition experts.
Okay.
One of them is going to go to Colorado. Colorado is having they call it a green lab. And so we're going to learn how to do the green lab. I actually can't wait to go to my boss and say I need to spend state parks money on buying some dang kush. So
fight is over.
Yeah. So we'll not only the focus is going to be more on the influence of THC and cannabis as we go forward. And I think it's more of a problem now that it's legal, recreationally legal, and people don't understand that. When you're out on Puget Sound, that's federal waters and it's still not legal. So there's some distinctions between terrestrial law and boating law as well. So it's an education process on one part, and then it's also some techniques that we have to train the officers on the other.
It was not considered when the CETA battery was developed because it wasn't legal at the point in any state. NASBLA, at the national conference we had last September, had a panel on this that we actually sat on. And sort of what we heard around the country was that DREs are hard to come by, especially on the water. And what we find is that there's not good numbers. Washington, as far as we know, is not well set up to track THC on the water or building influence for marijuana. The state drug lab or tox lab doesn't track it, and we haven't had a lot of conversations with them. They haven't been one yet for boating, so it's hard to have numbers. But anecdotally, talking to our officers, we've heard that what they're saying is the alcohol and marijuana are often linked, and once they find alcohol, they stop looking for THC. So we don't actually have really good stats on what the actual results are. Are you guys seeing similar things with driving? Or?
Is there, in terms of the data for the tox lab, just like the officers on the streets do for submission of blood samples and so forth, are the officers not submitting that to the tox lab for analysis?
Yes.
We would have the data if that were the case.
Well, BUI is a really complicated topic because of all the logistical issues of enforcing it. And like the land, when you have somebody seafaring and everybody's intoxicated or they're not capable of operating the vessel, mm-hmm. as soon as you arrest somebody, what do you do with the vessel? So there's... They might end the voyage and take them to shore and send them on their way and not arrest. There's a lot of issues involved. It's not a priority for prosecution. We've done some research. We've had over 100 arrests and like one actual prosecution out of that. So there's a lot. It gets kind of mixed up in a lot of logistical issues. We partnered with our partners at Department of Health, and they actually helped us develop did a full-blown policy review of our laws, actually. That covered a lot of these issues, so.
Yeah, the only way you're going to get good data then is take the approach that we do with DUIs. We have a zero tolerance, so that's how you get your data.
Yeah.
Everybody who's contacted for DUI or BUI needs to be arrested processed and the data would be captured that way.
Lieutenant Rob Sharp has been a real ally for us.
You bet.
He's been just terrific to work with, and he's been really helpful. So, yeah.
Whatever we can do to help.
Thank you. So, thanks
very
much.
Thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Okay. SAHSP report.
Okay, thanks. Pleasure to be with you today. I'm Chris Medill, Deputy Director here at the Commission. It does feel like a little bit of a reversal from the last several times I've been in front of you presenting, where I get to present something real positive, whereas before it was a little more disputed and difficult topics. It does sort of remind me of my last parent-teacher conference with my second oldest child, when I sat down and we prepared ourselves. She said, I'm going to get right to it. I have to tell you, Chase is doing really well. And I thought, oh, we'll work on that. We're going to get better, we promise. I wasn't quite sure how to respond to her. So it is a little reversal today, but I have the privilege of taking some credit for the real brains behind this rewrite project, which include Mike Abel back here, our program manager who's running the project, and then Catherine Boyd is our technical editor and writer for the plan. And I will tell you, it was at the Transportation Research Board annual meeting last week, and I met with a counterpart of mine from Louisiana. She said, oh yeah, I heard you guys are rewriting your Target Zero plan. And I said, yes, we are. She said, well, great, because you know last time we stole your priority structure. And she said she actually had a copy of their plan, and she said, see? And it looked just like our priority structure. So it was a nice little validation that Louisiana had followed suit with their priority structure. But I want to just give you a little bit of background, and I'll make this quite short, but Shelley talked about MAP 21, and that's our federal transportation bill, which now we have a new transportation bill, the FAST Act. And in that, there's a section 148, that's the Highway Safety Improvement Program, that requires every state to develop a strategic highway safety plan. So a comprehensive look at how we're going to address the fatalities and serious injuries on our roadways. So I hope you all recognize this, our beautiful plan from 2013. And this gives you just a little bit of a historical look. When we first adopted the Target Zero goal in 2000, we went to, in 2007, our first revision, which really overhauled that the pretty simple plan that we had in 2000. And then we've progressed 3 years every time. And in 2016, I just saw some of the preliminary drafts yesterday. It looks fantastic. We've revised our priority structure even again. So I have no doubt we'll find other states who will follow suit in that way. And I want to, of course, recognize our state traffic engineer, John Nisbet, who together with me, we co-sponsor the project for this revision. We have a great working relationship with the Department of Transportation. In fact, John and his agency have very kindly been paying the salary for Mike as he's run this revision project. So it's a great partnership. We really appreciate that infusion of funds for us. We don't have a lot of discretionary money to invest in this sort of thing. DOT stepped up and said that they do it. So just a few of the key elements. We think, appeal to a broad stakeholder group. We're talking state-level traffic safety organizations, but also at the local level. We've had reports of local city councilmen and county commissioners using the Target Zero plan and some of the strategies there to address traffic safety issues in their jurisdictions. So it's a real pleasure. But it does appeal to a large audience, which means it's fairly large. It's big. There's a lot of pages here. We're doing our best to try and consolidate it a little bit so that it's not overwhelming. It's not 150 pages like our sort of USDOT recently announced a Beyond Traffic plan, and it was about 160 pages. We're trying to keep it slim, but just to warn you, it's still going to be a fairly lengthy document. We're trying to cut it to the things that are most important, those strategies, key discussions about data, the key elements that will help state and local jurisdictions address the safety challenges. This just gives you an idea of kind of how we've been running the project, and we've done this for probably the last three revision efforts. We have a steering committee, large steering committee, of which every commission agency has a representative. We have a few other representatives there. We have kind of this core project team, which helps guide the project over the period of about 18 months. That's about how long the revision process takes. And then we have a larger group of partners. Many of you were able to attend our partners meeting in December, early December at the Great Wolf Lodge. Tremendous, I think, results and outcome was well received by our partners. And we got a lot of good things done. So this is really how we run the project. And this, I guess the final slide just gives you an idea of some of the milestones. We did ramp this up in the May, June timeframe. We're all the way up here to January 2016, where we're working on individual chapters, and those drafts are due, is it tomorrow, Mike?
Yes, sir.
All chapter drafts are due tomorrow. And Mike's got his emails, his scathing emails ready to send for those who don't get it, right? We'll then move into the assembly of the final draft and then a review and approval process, which includes review processes for tribes for a broader public review period. And then we'll go to a final draft here. And we hope sort of mid to late summer we'll move toward commissioner approval. And we'll present a lot of the highlights in the July meeting from the plan. And we hope to have your approval as we move toward the governor's signature in finalizing that revision process. So I'd be happy to take any questions you might have. Otherwise, I know we've got about 15 minutes left. Anything?
Just a comment on great work. Good uh-huh. work. And you speak of other states stealing our thoughts and ideas. That's a national. I mean, IECP, the state and provincial division in particular, every state police agency in the country has copied our Target Zero plan, and now we call towards zero deaths that every state's pursuing because of what we started here in Washington State.
Yes, pretty cool. Yes.
It's a credit to all of us.
And I saw just I got an email about our annual grants opportunity from somebody from Bellevue said they just recently adopted a zero vision in Bellevue, similar to what Seattle has done did last year. So it's great to see some of these larger municipalities following suit too, even in the state.
Yeah.
And I don't want to take away from Darren's time either, but I brought this for you, and I will leave this today. This is Vision Zero, and this comes out of the city of Los Angeles. Ironically, my daughter-in-law produced this and worked in that office when we were down there over the Christmas holidays, went to her office and saw their operation and so forth. It was really interesting. And she claims, because I've been providing her with some of the information that we have here, she claims we stole their name. But anyway, I think this is great. Anyway, I've been putting her in touch with people over here. She's also a graduate of the University of Washington, and so she gets involved with some of the studies that they're doing, but I'm going to leave this with you.
Okay.
Their target is really the downtown streets, so you know, with and also the highways. But what she her particular area is on that. But I'll leave this with you.
Yeah, thank you.
And with that, you're up.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for all being here today. And with the leg session and a lot of different things that many of you are very busy and hope that today you've learned a lot. We've had some really good discussions, especially around some of the legislative issues and some of the things that we're working on together. And I think it was just a testament, just to kind of show that we're not operating in silos. You know, when you look at this young driver committee that we're working on with the Department of Licensing, the things that we're working with the State Patrol, Department of Health, Department of or Department of Transportation, various projects that we're working together on. And then also now seeing state parks coming in and seeing how they are participating in helping us to get to zero. Because it takes all of us, and I think of the multi-agency, multi-disciplines working together to accomplish our goals. And so seeing this and hearing some of the feedback that we're getting nationwide, you know, I think sometimes we may take for granted the opportunities that we have here and what we have going. And but to look at seeing, you know, under our leadership and under your leadership, it's we're making a difference in people's lives. So I want to thank you for that. I wanted to just kind of, she's not here right now, but did you want to get Tammy really quick?
I can go get her.
Okay. I'll wait for her to come in because we've had a couple little changes here. But also, we had the partners meeting that was at the Great Wolf Lodge back in December. We had approximately 180 participants. Mike kind of took the charge on some of that. We had a lot of staff that were involved in that. I mean, I think everybody was at that that meeting. Great feedback from that, helping to help provide some additional direction, guidance to the steering committee and the project teams. But it's just nice to see that level of participation. James Waugh, who's our videographer, has put together a video, and I watched it yesterday, and it's about 7 minutes long, but it almost was like over, and I was like, man, that was amazing. And you know, lots of you were interviewed for that. It came across. I was like, how do we cut this down, and where do we cut it down? So it was just that well done. So in the coming the door is Tammy Barr,
Barr.
What did I say, Bear?
Mm-hmm. First you said Bar, then you said Bear.
So she is our new Fiscal Analyst 5. Today, or actually tomorrow, many of you have worked with Leslie Maltby for the last 7 years. And so Tammy has just been hired to fill her spot, and tomorrow Leslie Maltby will be her last day. Okay. So she didn't want to be, you know, recognized. She's, you know, hiding in the shadow, but I told her, I says, I'm still going to pull you out of your comfort zone. So, but we wanted to welcome Tammy as one of our new Fiscal Analyst 5. So many of you that, with some of the vouchers and things that are coming in, may see some new emails or some requests coming. And so I wanted you to be introduced to Tammy. So welcome aboard. The as has been mentioned several times, the FAST Act, which is the Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act, was signed by the President in December, and we're looking, you know, obviously there's some significant changes in there in some areas, and so we're trying to identify those so that we have a better analysis of that. We have the grant announcements that have gone out for the 2017 grants. And the 2017 grants is where the FAST Act will actually apply. Now, those will begin October 1st. Now, our grant deadlines are February 12th. So, I know many of you and your staff have some grants that are going. Everything is being done electronically through our Washington Enterprise Management System. Is that correct?
Yes.
They've trained me well. And so that's an electronic grant management system, so everything is going to be coming in electronic this year, all grant applications, so we won't have to be dealing with paper. And then we're working to finalize, I mean, we've had the vendor here the last 2 days working through some of the next phases of that so that we can have it as a full comprehensive system and not just to just take grants in, but to then build that out. That was a thing that a grant that was approved by all the commissioners to help us to get kind of modernized here in our agency to address the grants, the vouchers, project management, and those kind of things. So it's a huge change for us, and it's taken a lot of time and work to kind of see all the little nuances of how things work. I know we're short on time, but...
do we have a quorum now?
We're one short.
Yeah, I'll explain that in just a second.
Well,
the one thing I just wanted to share with you, obviously, is August 27th through the 31st, almost 7 months away. We've been talking about this for a while, but it's the Governor's Highway Safety Association's annual conference. That is where we'll have all governor's representatives for highway safety that will be here. It will be at the Sheraton in Seattle off 6th Avenue. And you know, you're going to have all kinds of traffic safety advocates, representatives there at that meeting. This is a huge national event, and we had made the bid for it about 2 years ago. We were granted that, and I can't believe that it's only 7 months away. And so put that on your calendars. We would love to have all of the commissioners there. We have put in a request. We'd love to have the governor there to do the opening presentation. The NHTSA administrator, Dr. Rosekind, will be a part of the opening presentation, and so we'll be calling upon some of you to help participate in that as far as some of the presentations, because as the commissioners, I have been trying to get you as in front of as many audiences as I can, because I think it's important that people understand who the commission is and who those commissioners are and what they and the agencies they represent. So that'll be August 27th through the 31st. Our fatal rates this year have, you have to leave. Okay, so let me, before you leave, I'll give you the fatal rates here in just a second. But I mentioned that Leslie is leaving tomorrow. Many of you have seen that Secretary Kevin Quigley will be leaving after session, or if he's replaced before that. So we're replacing that position. And sadly, but I'm excited for John Schneider, who was our commissioner for the Association of Cities, is now taking a new job with
the Governor's Policy Office as Outdoor Recreation and Economic Development Policy Advisor.
So we have lost John.
We gained him.
We wanted to recognize Commissioner Schneider, and I will still call you that today. Just with a little thing, if you just wanted to come up for a second. Commissioner Schneider has been a very active and vocal advocate for traffic safety. You have been with us since about 2012, and we wanted to just give you a little token of our appreciation from the Traffic Safety Commission. To the Honorable John Schneider for his excellent service promoting traffic safety 2012 to 2016. Congratulations. And everyone that we like to provide them with our Washington Traffic Safety, our Traffic Safety Excellence coin. And your jacket looks a little barren, so we would like to have you, as you are amongst the halls of the legislature, and as this is the governor's commission, is that you can wear that proudly on behalf of us. So thank you very much, and if you would like to have a few moments,
no,
just say you.
Hey,
say
Darren,
I'm sorry that I had to
can you give him this before?
Did you want to come up?
I'd just like to give you this, too. And say thank you very much on behalf of the commission as a whole, but the patrol in particular. This is my chief's coin, and say thank you very much for
thank
your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been a great advocate for public safety, and we can't thank you enough.
Much appreciated. Well, I'm starting to have a much better appreciation for Sandy's job now, being in this new position for a week. I don't know how she does it with everything that she covers. She's amazing. But this commission has just been an incredible learning experience for me. I had to open my horizons and learn more about the entire gamut of traffic safety, and it's just been really terrific. It's been an honor to serve the fellow commissioners and to learn this agency, which is a terrific agency and does amazing work, work that is unique in the United States for what we do and how we approach it, the collaborative approach, which is the right approach, in my opinion, now that I've experienced it for 4 years. So it's been an honor, and I look forward to trying to work with AWC to recruit somebody quickly so you can get a quorum sometime soon to replace me. Thank you.
On that depressing note, I'm excited for John to be up there, but we are going to miss you a lot.
He's filling for me, so you get to see him.
Well, that's if that would happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we'd love to have them both here. So I'll just give you a quick update. As you know, in 2013, our fatal numbers were at 436. In 2014, we were at 462. And preliminary numbers, which my FARS analysts always like to say is like riding in wet sand with an incoming tide, we are currently sitting at 562. So we're 100 over. I think it's about a 20% increase over last year. I've just talked to some of my counterparts across the country. They're seeing anywhere between 8 and 14% increases in their states. So we're seeing this trend nationwide. And so as we're getting more and more information in, as you know, our FARS numbers or fatality final numbers are not complete until December 31st of the following year. So everything's still preliminary. And so I just wanted to at least give you that information where we're at. We are trying desperately, obviously, as you know. We have got several resource limitations, but as the grants are going out this time, we've got lots of different things. We're still trying to make that impact on behavior. And so one of the things I will tell you is, in addition to the federal grants that have been advertised, The Washington Impaired Driving Advisory Council, or WIDAC, had this last week the opportunity to review 22 or 23 grants for funds that we get from the BAC fee that comes into the commission to actually help to supplement some of those federal grants. So there'll be state funds going out to help with impaired driving, court watch, you know, some of these other areas that federal funds may not necessarily be a good fit. And we had other grants that were in there, we're like, oh, this should be a federal grant. So we were had some great conversations with a lot of different agencies. So there's lots of things there, lots of opportunities, and things that we're trying to work through. So we are at our time. There's some additional things that I had here, but we can cover those at a later time. But I just wanted to say thank you for your time and your dedication to this commission, because it does make a difference in people's lives. And I also wanted to say to my staff, if they would just quickly stand, probably everybody on the other side, is, oh, please stand, is, you know, as the commissioners, you really require a solid staff to get the work done that you direct us to do. And this, these people are talented, they are skilled, and they are very competent people. And I am proud to work alongside every one of them. So I think they deserve a round of applause. So with that, I will turn my time back to you, Madam Chair.
Okay, unless there's any other business to come before the group, it says it's time to adjourn.
So move.
So we can't vote on it anyway.